For reasons unknown, J.J. Abrams has declared a one-man war against zombie takeout. Welcome to episode 511 of Zombie Takeout, the B-Movie and Cult Movie Show. I'm John.
Hello, I'm Scotto.
And before we get to this week's movie, you mentioned some tweets from Justine Bateman.
Yes. It's really about the strike and AI. And of course, it's, you can find them on Twitter yourself, of course.
Yeah, but I read them.
It's a lot about the possibilities of AI and just some stuff I really just hadn't thought of. You know,
SAG-AFTRA has okay to strike for next month.
Oh yeah,
and you know those negotiations are going to go to shit too. So the actors are going to strike. Just going to put this out there: in the short term, there will be a glut of reality TV because they don't need writers or actors for it.
I think there's. I think they've been preparing for this for a very long time. I think they've stockpiled, when I say they, the streaming services have stockpiled a lot of content.
Yeah, a lot of shows, I've you know, at least the stuff I'm aware of, a lot of that is already written, so they're filming now. If the actors strike, it fucks that.
Right, I think the effects won't be on them until like next year, really, for some of them.
Unless the actors go, in which case, reality TV. And beyond that, thinking that actors are going to have anybody, I'm going to say, and I said this to you off air, I think in Messenger, within 20 years, there will be no more creatives in the entertainment industry.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of how the music industry is faring already, you know?
Once an AI can act and write and make music, why are the suits going to work with people?
And it's just what Justine Bateman really brought up that I hadn't considered. You know, taking the CGI that we're using to de-age and to bring people that are dead back in their likeness, to couple that with AI, it's just, I mean, it's chilling and it's, you know, intriguing at the same time. You know,
I'm not a huge gamer, but I do watch a lot of gameplay on YouTube. And what they can do visually in games right now with computers is downright photorealistic.
Right. We are not far from what she's talking about, too. And I mean, she suggests that they could just, you know, make another season of Family Ties because they could just feed all of their images from every episode into the AI and CGI it and
her point the two together. And her point was get your likeness rights nailed down so they can't use your rights without paying you.
Right.
And she's right about that.
Think about it. They can use their likeness for any sort of promotion. That's free and fair for them to use to promote the show. And they could argue legally that creating a new season is promotion for the show.
Yeah.
And they didn't have to work for it because, you know, they did this work already and they were paid for it.
I've been aware of likeness rights for years because I, on and off again, collect action figures. And that's why some movie action figures look exactly like the actor and some don't. If the toy company has secured the likeness rights, the toy will look like the actor. If not, it won't.
So some of the things she brought up, though, just really, I mean, just the on-demand AI-generated stuff, you know, where somebody could put their face on Luke Skywalker's and their ex, you know, wife's face on Darth Vader or something. Just watch the movie that way.
Big future of this in gaming again. You know, if you can make your character look exactly like you with realistic facial expressions.
And I think they've done stuff like that, haven't they? Where you can put your picture in and
Toyed with it, but it's been kind of kludgy. If AI nails it down, that'll go big.
Yeah.
But I mean, she's got a good point, and I agree with her. But I don't see the future being using existing actors.
Right.
In a few years, a big deal being made about the first AI character in a movie.
Oh, wow. So they were not even using a likeness of a person.
It'll be the first completely computer-generated, computer-controlled AI character in a movie. It'll be a whole big deal. It'll be an animated film because that's easier. And then it will slowly become commonplace for AI actors to be in films and to be writing, and they'll just slowly push the creatives out of the industry. I'm reminded of what George Lucas said to Ron Howard when Howard told him that he'd been accepted to UCLA Film School. He told him, "Go into animation, that way you won't have to work with actors."
Right. And I think we'll look back on what Lucas did as kind of the harbinger of all that to come.
Part of it, yeah. But I don't think worrying about your likeness rights is going to be a big. It's going to be a thing in the short term, because we've all seen what's happened with holograms and, in terms of voices. I've said this off air. I don't know if I've said this on air. I learned this after a few years of editing podcasts. Give me 10 minutes of audio from anyone, and I can make them say anything.
Well, true. And I mean, God, if you take the stuff we've done
And if
over
an
the
amateur
years here,
human can do
yikes.
that, think of what a computer can do when, that is a billion times faster and more precise than a human.
And I mean, they've done it for comedic effect on stuff like The Daily Show or The Late Show or whatever. And it's, obvious that they make it obvious that it's fake, because it's the joke, because, you don't
Yeah,
want
of
to
course.
make it sound like he's really saying it, but with some touch, you can make it sound like he was really saying it.
Yeah, I have on at least one occasion that I remember made you say something you did not say. And I cleared it with you beforehand. You had forgotten to say something in the episode. I think it was thanking somebody for something.
Oh, right.
And I messaged you afterwards, like, is it cool if I, edit that together?
How did you get me saying somebody, I guess I've talked about them before.
There is a space between every syllable you say.
Yeah.
There is always a pause between a syllable. So you can take a syllable, and there are only a set number of phonemes in any given language. You take that, it's not hard to clip that syllable, put it together with another syllable. With a little pitch correction, you can make it go up or down, depending on what you want, the intention of the statement to be. Again, if an amateur human can do it relatively easily, a computer can do it without a problem. So it's definitely going to go that way, but I still see wholesale AI generated content that
Yeah.
doesn't involve any humans or
Just
any likenesses.
minimal. I mean, a lot of stuff has already begun where they're kind of strong-arming the writers out. NPR just did a great interview with David Simon, the created The Wire. And just how writers' rooms are nothing like what they
Oh,
used to
yeah.
be in the past.
Writers are basically freelancers at this point.
Yeah, definitely. And residuals are how they would be able to spend a year writing something, because like while you're putting a show together, you're not actually getting paid for your work. You don't get paid until you sell the show. And so how they would be able to do this was that they'd collect residuals while they're working on the next project, residuals from the past projects to work on the future. But if they're not getting residuals from the past projects, well, how can you do this? Then you're not making any money. Then unless of course you just happen to be independently wealthy or something, or you've had a lot of success in the past. But and by them not putting like writers' rooms together, it's why you could notice a difference in the quality of some writing, and how a lot of it's just nostalgia bait pretty much right now more than
And
anything
as we were
else.
talking about last time, most people don't want anything they have to think about. They
Yeah.
want simple brain off. Oh, that looks pretty. That was fun. That was entertaining. A computer can give them that.
It almost feels like the movie we're about to review is AI generated, actually.
But in the 90s, MTV created The Real World. I'll give them credit and say largely as a social experiment.
Yeah.
What they learned is this sort of content can be extremely successful and very cheap to produce.
Super cheap, yeah. Well, that was the whole thing of MTV, was how can we produce programming
Right.
for as little as possible?
A decade later, the networks caught on, and there was an absolute glut of reality TV
Yeah, from the
because
last strike.
they, yeah, and I think, yeah, it probably came to a head during the last strike because they didn't need writers, they didn't need actors. It was cheap, successful, which means the stockholders made a shitload more off of it than they would have off of fictional television.
And that's where everything comes down to what the stockholder, everything
And that's,
about
again,
publicly traded
yeah,
is about the
that is
stockholders.
the bottom line. It is a business. It is about profit and growth. Create the product as cost effectively as possible, sell it to the customer for as much as they will pay, and grow.
And I understand the love for reality shows in the early days.
Humans are different. I mean, I loved The Real World back in the day. I
But
was into
after a
Survivor
while,
and Big Brother for a while.
right, like like Survivor in the first few seasons, I understood, The Apprentice, all those things, like, but once you got past like a couple of seasons of them, maybe even three or four, it was kind of like a, all right, we've done all of this already, man.
I
There's no
agree.
new
That's why I
stakes.
got bored with them after
Well,
like
yeah.
I got bored with The Real World after like 3 or 4 seasons. Same with the others.
Yeah. I will still watch stuff if it comes down to cooking or baking or different crafts because of the wife, of course.
I mean, I watch mostly YouTube, which arguably is reality TV.
That's true. That's true. But I like the skill, being
But my mother
involved.
was absolutely hooked on Big Brother. She loved it because it was something to watch 3 nights a week.
I never understood the love for Big Brother, honestly.
It was mildly entertaining if you get into the
Yeah.
strategy. But she just liked it because it was something that was on 3 nights a week.
And I guess you could also say sports are reality TV too, in a way.
It was background noise.
Yeah.
That's what most people want on TV, is just background noise. Yeah, like I said last week, most people do not consume content like we do.
I mean, I consume sports and like I said, the cooking and baking, but
And I think the baking shows definitely fit, although they are a bit more interesting from what I've seen.
I want to pick up skills, but not in sports, obviously, but
In terms
baking,
of the
cooking.
bottom line, sports is very different because obviously professional athletes make a lot of money.
Yeah.
So they still have to get paid. But, your Big Brother, your Survivor, even, Great Bake Off, or whatever the hell it's called,
Oh, yeah.
the not infringing US title, or the
Yeah.
Great British Bake Off.
I was gonna say, yeah, there's a different name depending on the country you're in, whether
Yeah,
it's.
so they don't infringe.
Yeah.
But that's the same principle because those people aren't getting paid the same way. They're probably just getting a per diem
Yeah,
while they're
and then
there.
the final prize.
Yeah. Same thing's gonna happen in music. The minute a computer can write and perform and produce a song, every human is out. In Japan, they've had what are called Vocaloids for years. It's an animated character who, with a, using a voice synthesizer, will sing.
Oh, wow.
A human writes the music
Yeah.
and, plays some of the track. But the voice is all done computerized, the character is computerized. It's a short step to a completely AI artist.
Yeah, I mean, I'll find a way to use it myself.
Oh, I was thinking about this. I watched, I'll put a couple of links down in the description. Well, one in particular by Samurai Guitarist about AI, about the AI Beatles song that's out there now.
I mean, what's the sense of fighting it? Why not find a way to make something out of it?
I was thinking about it, and like, I don't think I would touch it with my music. At least that was my initial thought. Because
Yeah.
my whole thing with music is, raw and authentic and all of that, imperfect. If I could get an AI to edit these podcasts, I'd do that in a fucking heartbeat.
I've had mashups in my head for decades, and I'll be able to do them. You're going to hear Nine Inch Nails performing Genesis's Invisible Touch finally for real.
But then I remembered that a couple of months ago, DistroKid, the service I use to put my music on Spotify and YouTube Music and Amazon, et cetera, rolled out this mastering service where you could click some buttons and it would master your song. It would basically polish it.
Wow.
Only reason I didn't use it was that it was a little too expensive for me.
Yeah.
And that had to be AI. So I think, yeah, I guess I would use it. But bottom line, yes, if you're a working creative dealing with major mainstream media, nail down your fucking rights. Good luck with the contracts. If you're a consumer who still wants to consume art made by human beings, start looking at small studios, small labels, independents. That's the only place you're going to find it.
Yeah, I think this is going to be a huge shot in the arm for live theater.
Live theater is another example.
Like, you know, stuff that the Goodman and the Steppenwolf are doing here. I'm trying to remember the theaters in New York that were the smaller guys, well, mid-size at least. And then Chicago, of course, has a ton of storefront theaters too.
They can't really replace actors in that situation.
I think, you know, the Broadway things are going to be holograms, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point.
That is huge budget stuff, ridiculous ticket prices. But I think, like, the real theater is going to, you know, it's going to be about the human experience and being there, which it's always been about, really.
Yeah. And if you're looking at recorded filmed media, again, small labels, small studios, Magnet releasing, A24, I think they're still going to be okay.
Yeah.
Independent
creators. They're already like ahead of the game. You know, they know what people are looking for.
Bandcamp. I always plug Bandcamp because, you know, my stuff's on there, but that's all independent artists. Those are the people who aren't making billions in dollars on it are the people who are still going to be human based.
Yeah.
Anyway, finally on to this week's movie, which is from 2013, Star Trek Into Darkness. Of course, that brings us to the impromptu plot summary, sponsored by Crowbars. Need to squeeze a popular old film into a new one that doesn't need it? Then use a crowbar and beat everyone over the head with that needless nostalgia.
And also brought to you by Melodramas. Substitute your ice floes for zero grav shenanigans by moving your melodrama into space. All right, so we have, they pretty much begin where they left off. They're on a planet surveying, and when I saw this in the theater, this is pretty much the only part of it I remember.
Both the second and third one, and I love the third one, begin with Kirk in trouble.
Oh, yeah. I don't think I'd ever seen the third one in its entirety, but this one I did see. And like I said, I'm wondering if I fell asleep or something later on in the movie in the theater. But they are on a planet surveying, and things have gone south.
They weren't surveying. They stole a religious icon in order to lure these primitive people away from a volcano.
Okay. Well, they were surveying.
You just first see them running.
Right. They were surveying the planet. They discovered the volcano, and then obviously they concocted this stupid plan to, you know, lure them away from the volcano so they could lower an ice cube into a volcano or whatever it was into the volcano to deactivate it. And, and of course, the plan pretty much works. Of course, there's hitches. The natives, you know, chase them and are trying to kill them.
The plan actually goes very, very sideways and costs them the Enterprise.
True.
And almost kill Spock.
They almost kill Spock, and they make a crazy jump off a cliff that, if you're into the laws of physics, should never have worked.
Any Critical Role fans out there, were practically gods.
Yeah, pretty much. they have to do a crazy rescue of Spock, and they violate the Prime Directive in so many ways, and they completely get away with it except for the first officer of the Enterprise files a full report of everything Kirk did. And they get bussed down, both of them. Like, Spock gets transferred to another ship. Kirk gets bussed down to first officer. And, but none of that matters because there's a crisis along the way here. There's this evil genius who concocted this terrorist attack on the archive station.
It becomes a different movie for a little bit, starring Mickey from the first season of Doctor Who.
And yeah, it's all very like, and then from here on out, Kirk figures out that the attack is just kind of a ruse to get them all together, but he figures this out too late because the attack happens, and unfortunately, of course, for Pike, well, he buys it, or does he? No, he buys it
It's a
definitely.
different bike. They can tell this one.
He buys it. He almost says avenge me, but I think he dies before that happens.
He probably said it to Kirk, to
He
Spock
probably.
internally.
Oh yes, Spock does a mind meld on him just to watch him die.
Much. Spock almost died in the beginning of the film, so he did a mind meld on Pike to
Pike.
see if Pike was thinking the same thing that Spock was thinking when he was about to die.
Yes. He shot a man in Reno. They get the ship back, of course, because, well, everyone's dead almost, except for the Admiral, played by RoboCop, who, when
He
you see
said,
RoboCop is playing the Admiral, you know he's not going to have a small role.
or Buckaroo,
Right, okay,
who
yeah, we'll
tells
say
him, go
Buckaroo.
get the motherfucker.
We'll say Buckaroo. It would have been great when he came into the whole space battle if, like, Uptown Girl was playing. Never mind. That's too deep a cut.
Yeah, that one was even over my head.
Jeff Goldblum is first officer, maybe. I don't know.
Was that him? It's been ages since I've seen Buckaroo. I don't
Yeah.
remember Uptown Girl. Oh, the last song kind of was reminiscent of
They
Uptown Girl,
used
right?
that instead of the last
Oh,
whatever thing they
right.
had.
That was the
It's
track they were actually hearing when they walked around the
yeah.
LA Lake.
Ridiculous. Sorry about that, guys. It's such a digression in the impromptu plot summary.
We're already at 23 minutes and we haven't even started the review.
Jesus Christ. All right, so the only thing they can do is to go to the Klingon world, stay on the edge of the neutral zone, and he's hiding out of the Klingon world when he gets away with this a dastardly deed, and fire these photon torpedoes, these special photon torpedoes from a distance, hope the Klingons somehow don't notice.
Cut to Max von Sydow in latex quoting Shakespeare.
Right, look at the hell. Like, why wouldn't Kirk right away be like, well, that's the stupidest plan I've ever heard? But, hold my beer. They decide to violate this order, to not just fire torpedoes randomly into some, area that he's uninhabited area that he's hiding out in, and instead go down to arrest him. It's then revealed that in these special photon torpedoes are then, after of course a daring, fight scene where Kirk and spoiler Khan, he's
Benedict
Khan,
Cumberbatch playing Khan Noonien saying, yeah.
and so they yes, it's revealed that he's Khan. They fight off the Klingons and they take him in, and he surrenders to him for some reason. But of course, the reason is revealed that in these torpedoes is one of each a member of his crew.
I would have given it half a brain if that one they opened showed Judson Scott.
Oh, the Phoenix.
Because he was in Con as well.
Well, yeah, that would have been great, wouldn't it? But anyway,
He was kind of Khan's
they
first
do not
officer.
go that deep with this. So while they're bringing him back, their engine has some failure because they were, well-timed sabotage from Buckaroo, and he shows up, of course, and they have a bit of a battle, and they're kind of dead in space, just like, the Nebula scene, kind of.
You're completely forgetting Kirk's baby mama.
Kirk's what?
Kirk's baby mama.
Kirk's baby mama.
At least Kirk Prime's baby mama. Dr. Marcus.
Oh, yes. Dr. Marcus stows away on the ship, kind of. Well, at least lies to get onto it. And I'm not sure exactly what purpose her character served.
Because she was in Wrath of God.
True. She's not That's doing Project Genesis this time. And
David's not there yet. It's like, I gotta give him credit. They didn't do like a romantic subplot to like lean toward the Prime Universe there.
That is true. They kind of give each other a look at the very end. But,
there's this completely needless shot of Alice Eve in her underwear. Plenty has been said about that.
And like the way she posed for it too, you know. Mm-hmm. And the weird thing was they used that for the ad for the movie. I remember that. Yeah. And then seeing it was just kind of like a, wow, that was really shoehorned in.
And, you know, Kirk was notoriously a playboy, so that scene with him with the twins, with the towels in that one shot, was fine. That fits his character. They did a similar thing in the first one. But, yeah, let's see, in her underwear thing was just, why was she even changing? There's a bit from Kids in the Hall, the Terrier song. Dave McCullough singing this song about, or Bruce McCullough singing this song about terriers. He gets to this verse in a graveyard, and then he says bass solo, and there's like two bars of him plunking away on a Beatle bass, and then he looks over and sees these two women in black bikinis and veils in the graveyard. He stops playing, goes over to them, and says, "Ladies, you're scantily clad and have nothing to do with the narrative, therefore this is sexist. I'm going to have to ask you to leave." And then goes back to the song. I was reminded of that in that shot.
I mean, I guess you gotta say JJ's gotta eat. I mean, I don't know.
I'm tempted to go to my What Have I Learned Already, but I'll hold off.
JJ gotta eat. Where was I? Oh, yeah. The space battle, and they, of course, beam over. Or no, they don't beam over. They do the whole fly through space thing in the zero grav suit. Mm-hmm. To, you know, of course. And Scotty somehow snuck his way onto the ship from before because he got fired. And
also, Buckaroo's ship can chase them in warp.
Yes. Buckaroo's ship can go through warp. And, they nearly destroyed the Enterprise there. And they run through the ship to get to Buckaroo on the bridge. And yet another fight, a couple fight scenes along the way. Buckaroo's crew really does suck. They're stormtroopers out of their uniform. Yeah. They're really easy, you know, fodder just to stretch. It felt like this movie, a lot of it was just to stretch time, you know? They kept coming up with ways to keep the movie going.
Right.
It eventually works, winds up with them blowing up Buckaroo's ship. And, but of course, it doesn't matter because, you know, Khan survives that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then their ship suddenly starts, you know, spiraling out of control. And of course, they get control back at the last second. But wait, there's, you know, Khan, you know, crashing down into Earth. And then they got to go get Khan. But then they got to bring Khan back to, you know, save, you know, Kirk. Mm-hmm. And man, hilarity ensues.
Mm-hmm. And a hell of a fight scene.
Yes.
I'd like to think that if Peter Weller heard this episode, he'd find it refreshing that we were mostly referring to him as Buckaroo instead of RoboCop.
Yeah, I think he'd be a fan if he listened to us. So someone share this with them, please.
I like the head fake at the beginning that they were actually trying to save these people. Because the first thing they say is that, you know, they stole this religious icon and they're running away from these, you know, primitive people. And, you know, it was just a nice head fake. Although trying to save them at all was kind of interfering with the Prime Directive, which they do mention.
I mean, it's funny because it's Kirk and no matter what timeline is, fuck your Prime Directive. Visually, though, beautiful.
I just realized the underwater shot of the Enterprise was kind of a reference to Voyage Home, because they do have to go underwater in that one.
Well, I don't think they went underwater, but I think they were in... I was thinking...
I knew the Enterprise in the original movies, in the TOS movies, had to go underwater at some point.
Oh, wait a minute. It wasn't the Enterprise. They were in the Klingon Bird of Prey.
That was it, yes.
Yeah. But visually, the whole scene on that planet was just tremendous. The red plants, the white natives. I mean, just visually, it was just
gorgeous. The whole movie looks great. I mean...
Yeah, but that more than any part else.
Well, the ending is a bit of a nod to Michael Bay, but, you know, if I got to give Bay any credit, he makes it look good. All I could think during the scene with Spock in the volcano was it's a good thing Vulcan is a hot planet. But it was nice to see a futuristic car. I think that might be a first in a Trek, in anything Trek.
I don't know how...
To see, like, a 23rd century car?
Hmm.
We briefly see... I'm just going to call him Mickey because he didn't really get a name.
Oh.
The other movie that interferes, you have this father in the 22nd century at some point who has a very, very sick daughter who gets propositioned by Benedict Cumberbatch saying, I can save her. And it's these dark, slow-moving scenes that do not fit in with the rest of the movie.
Yeah, just trying to give a little background as to how he got in there, you know? And I don't know, is any of that necessary?
Khan convinces Mickey to blow up a building.
Yeah.
And we find out that building was Section 31. Section 31 was just beginning at this point.
Yeah.
And then the cover story is that he had found out that Section 31 was doing some shit, so he took action against them. That should have been the fucking movie. A rogue Section 31 agent attacking Section 31 and going on the lam would have been brilliant. Wouldn't have involved Khan.
Yeah. There's just a lot of nostalgia shoehorned into this.
And just forget the whole Klingon thing.
Didn't really fit.
Because inevitably he's the bad guy. He's going to fail. But if the guy who tried to take down Section 31 fails... Think of the tension of that, because we, as Trek fans, know how fucking evil Section 31 in the Prime universe is. We can assume they were just as evil in the Kelvin universe.
I think they weren't counting on people knowing what Section 31 is. That's the thing with these. They're really going for the non-Trek fans.
You mentioned it doesn't go deep. It goes very broad.
Yes. Hugely broad. The considering that they were going for people that were casual fans, there's no need for the nostalgia that they overloaded with.
And those people might remember Khan because Khan is like the most loved of all the Trek movies. They've never seen Undiscovered Country. Hell, we're Trekkies. We don't even we reviewed it years ago, a handful of years ago. We don't remember Undiscovered Country.
Right. I always forget about that one. I think I remember we reviewed it. It was like, wow, this is quite a surprise. I completely forgot about this part.
We saw it in the theater.
We did.
Together.
We did.
Didn't remember it when we reviewed it. Neither of us remembered it going into this movie. I had to look it up because I vaguely remembered it had to do with something about a war with the Klingons. And I reminded you of it. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's what it was about.
Like, I remember the zero grav mass shooting.
Right.
And this movie is exactly the same. I only remember the beginning with the natives. Uh-huh. And then after that, all of this was new.
Yeah, same. I did not remember anything other than the comically tragic casting of Benedict Cumberbatch and Alice Eve's pointless underwear scene. That's literally all I remembered. I forgot all of this other bullshit that they crowbarred in.
I mean, right. The references, the direct references to Wrath of Khan, I was like, I just in shock. They really went there? They really? I mean, he unironically yells Khan.
And the pacing is just a mess. All of the stuff with London and Mickey just doesn't fit with the tone of the Kelvin verse.
The weird thing about this, it's like somebody wrote a story and then they just kept coming back a couple days later going, well, how can I make this longer? Well, I know, this could happen with me. You know, when they're doing this, like they just kept adding and then adding and then adding.
It was like the writers were improving, but in a bad way. They just kept saying yes and yes and.
Yes. So it felt like they had a 45-minute story that they just kept adding different fight scenes, different battle scenes, you know.
It was an excuse to blow shit up and get over dramatic.
Yeah.
I did like Bones examining Kirk while he's arguing with Spock.
Yes.
Carl Urban is a great Bones. Might be the best thing about the Kelvinverse.
And it feels like every movie and even show just has to have this big, you know, cataclysm, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, you just can't have a story for the sake of a story.
Yeah.
There has to be, oh my God, this huge giant thing just happened that mm-hmm. never gets mentioned anywhere else ever again, by the way.
I liked Spock's speech about choosing not to care when he was in the volcano.
Man, they almost gave us some good death scenes, but they just of course cheated us.
I've always liked the dynamic between Zoe Saldana's Uhura and Zachary Quinto Spock. That's always been a great story.
It got a little too light here, I felt, you know? Like, everything's just we're just one, you know, big family kind of, you know, like Spock has two girlfriends, you know.
Yeah.
Uhura and Kirk, of course. And then, of course, Bones is kind of the jealous, you know, what about me?
Did Spock's voice seem more put on in this one than the last one?
It just seemed
like Quinto was trying too hard.
I think that's the beauty of Spock, is you can just have that same delivery. You know, of course, he breaks and you know, gives into his emotions in this, but, you know...
Maybe that's why it seemed like he was trying too hard. In those more angry scenes, he was still doing the voice and it seemed more fake there. The warp chase was cool. I got to give him credit for that.
Yeah. I mean, I think the action scenes work. It's just they don't make any sense together.
It's a good thing they had that nice long runway for the spacewalk. Once they got into the Vengeance, they had that nice long piece of empty floor. I mean, it makes sense because everything was sucked out, but the way they shot it really draws attention to the fact that they had this nice long piece of floor to slide on.
Was it a... It couldn't have been a shuttle bay. Why wouldn't they have just gone through a shuttle bay? You're like, why would there just be... It's like Galaxy Quest. Why would there be a little porthole?
Yeah, a door you can open into space in this random cargo bay.
Right. Why would it have been a cargo bay entrance?
A little bit of trivia, by the way, on the casting of Benedict Cumberbatch. On TrekMovie.com, co-producer and co-screenwriter Bob Orsi addressed Khan's casting, saying, quote, "Basically, as we went through the casting process and we began honing in on the themes of the movie, it became uncomfortable for me to support demonizing anyone of color, particularly anyone of Middle Eastern descent or anyone evoking that." One of the points of the movie was that we must be careful of the villain within us, not some other race. Khan Noonien Singh was a Sikh. He was from India. He was not Middle Eastern.
I mean, wasn't Ricardo Montalban Mexican?
Spanish, yeah. But that was the 60s, so different rules. But also, they were perfectly fine with making Noel Clarke, a black man, the actual suicide bomber.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was early in his career, but Kumail Nanjiani was right there.
I don't know. Does he really have the acting chops?
He's done some amazing dramatic stuff.
All right.
I'm thinking him. I'm thinking maybe Cal Penn right before Obama, you know, fucked him out. Cal Penn would have been an interesting choice. I don't know if he was acting at this point. I don't remember how far back Community goes. But Danny Pudi, Abed from Community, as Khan, would have been fascinating.
We're just getting an unknown, you know? I mean,
well,
I
don't all think... three of them would have been relative unknowns at that point, except Cal Penn because of Harold and Kumar.
Yeah. But, and I don't think a lot of people would have bought
it would have been Harold interesting. And Kumar.
Although then you already have Sulu.
Yeah, true. And I mean, given what
they're a little weird.
It's just such a bullshit excuse for casting a name.
Yeah.
They put Cumberbatch in there because, if I recall correctly, this was around the time Sherlock was blowing up.
Yeah.
So he was huge. He was about to get sucked up by the MCU. So they capitalized on a name and cast him as one of the most infamous villains. And that whole thing about not wanting to demonize a person of color. Yeah, Khan is a villain, but he's a fucking legendary villain.
Yeah.
No one would have complained about playing Khan.
Right. You know, it'd be like, you know, we don't want, you know, a Jewish Shylock, because, you know.
Now, back to the film, the storyline. Did the bridge crew know about the other Spock? Because if not, that phone call must have been weird.
I can't remember. That's a good point.
I thought only Spock and maybe Kirk knew about him.
Hmm. He was working on a pretty high-profile project, though, of preserving Vulcan culture.
Yeah.
So they would have had to have known he existed.
Starfleet, yes. Obviously Kirk and Spock, of course. But everybody else on the bridge would have been like, wait, that's another you. I don't think random bridge crew would have known. Of course, they do change things up a little bit. Kirk dies instead of Spock.
Well, dies in quotes. Yeah. But then again, you could say that about the original too, but at least they left it go
right
in the movie.
Just as Spock is chasing Khan through San Francisco, where he crashed the Vengeance, which was completely a page out of Bay's book.
Yeah.
They send Uhura down to phase him a bunch of times because they need to take Khan alive, because the blood sample that was taken earlier in the film had regenerative powers that could save Kirk.
And you knew that's where it was going, you know, yeah, as soon as like he dies, but it's like, we know this isn't the last movie. So you can't kill off Kirk and then have another movie after this.
Well, I don't know if we knew that at the time.
Probably not at the time, ma'am.
It was nice to see her get the assist.
Yeah.
Nichelle Nichols was so sidelined, even in the movies, that I like that they give Zoe Saldana a lot more with the character.
Right, and that came to be expected. At first I was kind of like, oof, that means they, you know, gave a lot less to Bones to do, but, you know...
Mm.
I think the balance works out.
Oh, yeah. And I like that Sulu got the chair. The captain's chair.
Right.
It gave him some nice moments. I've always been a fan of John Cho.
It would be pretty cool if they gave him, a movie in the Excelsior.
Yeah, of course. Well,
or a show.
Yeah. I would love, you know, I love the Kelvinverse. I'd love to see this cast continue. I don't think they will.
Well, who knows when the fourth one is... Or if when,
I think
if...
it's pretty much been sidelined. I mean, this was 2013. I'm going to say Beyond was like 15, 16.
And it's been
a long time.
Bandied about. It might happen. I guess we should say that for sequels and remakes.
Yeah, well, yeah. all I have left is that at the end they imply that Carol Marcus is joining the cast, the crew of the Enterprise.
Yeah.
She's not in the next one.
Oh.
Slight spoiler there. Oh, yeah, incidentally, and I won't reveal a name because it's a slight spoiler, but they were afraid of making a person of color the villain in this one, but Justin Lin, who directed Beyond, did not have that problem. The Asian director of Beyond did not have that problem.
All right. There were some really silly things in this, you know, like Earth had no defense system. That whole thing with the Enterprise just spinning out of control. There were no ships near Earth or based around Earth. It's just an empty planet. And just, isn't that neat? The Enterprise is here. Oh, it looks like they're out of control, and it looks like they could crash down at the planet. And there's Buckaroo's ship. That's going to come down too. I guess there's nothing here to actually stop that. Earth is just this undefended planet in this universe.
Too bad they didn't have a Highlander shield.
Absolutely ridiculous, though.
On to sequels and remakes.
On to sequels and remakes.
Of course, this was preceded by 2009, or just Star Trek, which we reviewed earlier in the year, and followed by Star Trek Beyond, which we'll be getting to in the fall. Both are better. You know, we gave it double five to 09.
Yeah, 09 is like one of my highest, you know, obviously one of the highest rated Trek movies
it's
for me.
It's probably my favorite Trek movie. I think 09 and Beyond are probably my top two Trek movies. Beyond is a little candy. It's, you know, it's a little lighter and cheesier, but I still love it. It's damn sight better than this piece of shit.
I had 09 and Generations as my top, and then First Contact and Khan.
I'd probably go up 09 and Beyond, and then I'd probably go Khan, just because the whole Ahab arc in First Contact gets a little iffy for me. Anyway, On a Brains.
On a Brains.
I can't say it's as bad as Nemesis, but it's not much better. I'm going 3.
I'm pretty close. I'm going 3.5. The action scenes are wonderful. Too much nostalgia, but the nostalgia, you know, for a Trek fan is nice to see a little bit. They just got carried away. And but it's the plot that fails this. It's just so ham-fisted, and it's just... Is there even really a plot to this?
No, it's just references.
It almost becomes like a Monty Python skit of like, how can we make this movie last 2 hours and 10 minutes? It just, oh, I know, there could be a system failure again, like just as they're approaching the planet. And then that guy can survive the explosion and he can come crashing down and make a fight scene on the planet. It was just, it was enough
like
already.
A kid putting, scripting a movie. Back when Family Guy was a thing, you complained about it using sub-references in place of jokes. This used sub-references in place of plot.
It did. It did. You know, just the fact that he yelled Khan unironically was just kind of like, what? But, I mean, anything is better than the motion picture.
I think Nemesis is worse. I actually would put TMP slightly above this.
TMP... has that whole first hour where there's nothing really happens.
Nothing really happens, but it makes sense. And they're not trying to crowbar anything in.
But it's not entertaining in the least.
But it makes sense, and it's not just blow shit up and make references to older shit. I mean, as much as, you know, of course, any Trek movie is a reference to older shit, but...
Yeah, TMP is all about the older shit.
It's just didn't irritate me as much.
Love anyway. Boat uniforms.
What everyone?
We learned that even if you put the red shirt on for a little bit, something bad could happen to you 3 years later. Rest in peace, Anton.
And I learned that J.J. Abrams must be stopped. I mean, I learned that with T-Roz, but actually I saw this first, but I should have known with T-Roz. Anyway, that's it for Star Trek Into Darkness. Until next time, it'll be reviewing The Master on the TV show. I found the first 6 episodes on YouTube.
Yeah, excited about that.
Yeah, hopefully we were both big fans of this show as a kid. I was doing a little research. I found out it wasn't based on Stephen K. Hayes. I was surprised.
Huh, okay.
Stephen K. Hayes, an American who went to Japan to study ninjutsu, wrote a bunch of books about it. I thought the character in The Master was based on him. It wasn't.
They had this whole fantasy of American ninjas back in the day, you know?
Incidentally, I thought the kid on the show, not the kid, the younger guy, was played by Michael Dudikoff from American Ninja. It was actually Timothy Van Patten, who I, of course, immediately assumed was Dick Van Patten's son. No, he was Dick Van Patten's Patton's half-brother.
Oh, wow.
Even though there's like a 40-something year age difference.
Wow, okay.
Anyway, that's next week. Until then, of course, always remember, never forget, wherever you go in life, there you are.
There you are.